This is Judaism Unbound, episode 127, A Synagogue Without Flags. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we continue to explore the relationship of American Jews and Israel with our guest today, Brant Rosen. Brant Rosen is the founding rabbi of a congregation called Tzedek Chicago that we'll talk about in the interview. He was ordained by the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College in 1992 and served congregations in Los Angeles, Denver, and Chicago before founding the denominationally unaffiliated congregation that he works at today. In addition to being the rabbi of Tzedek Chicago, Brant Rosen is the Midwest Regional Director of the American Friends Service Committee. He is a past president of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical Association and also is co-founder and co-chairperson of the Jewish Voice for Peace Rabbinical Council. Brant Rosen's blog called Shalom Rav is available at rabbibrant.com, and his book, Wrestling in the Daylight, A Rabbi's Path to Palestinian Solidarity, is available on Amazon and elsewhere. Brant Rosen, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So as we're in this series on the present and future of the relationship of American Jews in Israel, your congregation, Tzedek Chicago, is particularly interesting in the sort of position that it occupies in the question of the relationship between American Jews and Israel. I want to pick up in particular on part of the description that you have on your website where you talk about Tzedek Chicago being about, quote, an expansive diasporic vision that views the entire world as our homeland. And I'd love if you could sort of go into that and explain to us kind of where Israel and Zionism fit in the mission that you have for Tzedek Chicago.
I think for centuries of Jewish life, homeland was largely a symbolic idea. It was the diaspora where Jews lived and where Jews created community in throughout history and in many different cultural contexts. And that the diaspora was really the fertile soil through which Jewish life grew and was created. And with the rise of Zionism and eventually the establishment of the state, there was this flipping of the script, if you will. And the diaspora, you know, there's a concept, a Zionist concept that's known in Hebrew as Shlilat HaGalut, the negation of the diaspora, that Zionism was in many ways a rejection of the diaspora. And what had previously been a symbolic homeland, the land of Israel, that would be reestablished as a place for the Jews to live once the Messiah came, suddenly this was given political meaning and political context, and the whole term homeland, and even the word Israel itself, which previously meant the people of Israel, became attached to a political nation state. And we feel, many of us feel, I mean, I don't want to speak for all at Tzedek Chicago, because this is not a congregational dogma or anything like that. It's not that everyone is expected to believe the same thing necessarily, but in terms of the values that we espouse, we are trying to reclaim the diaspora as the homeland, if you will, in the very literal sense in which Jews have always made their home, as opposed to this very specific piece of land, which is today known as the State of Israel, which has in a way subverted what has been centuries of Jewish self-understanding.
Can you tell us a little bit about the story of how you came to where you are and these questions and how you came to found Tzedek Chicago? You know, I think that a lot of us are really used to going into a synagogue, just about any synagogue, and you look up in the front of the room and there you see an American flag and an Israeli flag. And in the middle, in between them, you see the Ark where the Torah is. And somehow this tableau is something that we see at just about every synagogue. And I guess I'm curious whether that was the case at the synagogues that you led in the beginning of your career. You know, how did you go from being a rabbi at a synagogue like so many others, if you did, and then come to create what you've created here?
So I'm a Reconstructionist rabbi. I grew up at a Reformed temple that had the two flags on either side of the Ark. And I became ordained as a Reconstructionist rabbi, and I served two Reconstructionist congregations in my career, one for 5 years in Denver and then for about 16, 17 years in Evanston, Illinois. And both of those places, I would say, are similar to most liberal congregations in terms of its approach to Israel, which is that Israel is very much an integral part of Jewish life. And we were taught Israel in school. We say the prayer for the state of Israel. We have programs on Israel throughout the year. We teach Israel to the children in our religious schools. We celebrate Yom HaTzmaut, Israel Independence Day, as a Jewish holiday along with the other regular Jewish holidays. And I think I would say that for my experience as a rabbi, I took all of that for granted. I've always been, up until I think relatively recently, I guess you would say, I considered myself a Zionist, definitely on the progressive end of the Zionist spectrum. And I will say, though, the issue of the flags was always, there were some things about being a Zionist always my whole life that made me a little itchy. You know, there were little voices that were saying, is this quite right? You know, and I would say that the flags on the Bima were definitely that. That it always felt really bizarre to me that we were, our most sacred text was the center and focus of our worship. And on either side, there are these political symbols of two nation states that we were praying towards equally as we were praying toward to the Torah. And it was always an issue on some level for me. And I remember in my previous congregation, the board of directors got a letter from a congregant saying that they objected to having the flags on the Bima. And we had a really interesting conversation about it. And we decided to take them down for a period of time and see and explain why and just see how people felt about it. And in the end, nobody was, there were some people who appreciated it. Nobody objected to it. And from that time on, we never had flags on the Bima. But looking back, I would say that having flags on the Bima is really close to idolatry, having political symbols in your most sacred of spaces that you are literally bowing toward, I think is enormously problematic.
So talk us through that next step. So you were at congregations that, of course, had their own unique identity, but as you said, were similar to many other liberally oriented congregations. And some set of things happened such that you no longer were in that world. And I don't know if it's not necessarily we need the story of why you left particular congregations, but it seems that you made a conscious decision. You could have gone and for a next stage after this congregation you were most recently at, you could have gone to another congregation in that general mold, but you set out onto this experiment of starting something that does seem very different in a context where there were never flags on the Bima because it was new. And you sort of got to, it's not that you yourself were the only one creating it. You have other people involved that are, I'm sure, lay leaders and congregants. But what sort of happened in these first few years that this new context has been created?
For all of my life, most of my adult life, I've considered myself a Zionist, and Israel has been a really important part of my Jewish identity. As I said before, too, though, there were always these moments where I would just question what Zionism was all about and question certain assumptions that I just took for granted as a Zionist. And there were a few instances of that. I think probably the biggest had to do with the fact that this is a state that considers itself a democratic state, and yet the very identity of the state is predicated on exclusively on the identity of one people. And that in order for that identity to be sustained and maintained, you need a demographic majority of that people in the land. When I would advocate for a two-state solution, like many liberal Zionists, I'd talk about the demographic threat that Palestinians posed a demographic threat to the Jewish nature of the state. And every once in a while, I'd sort of stop and really listen to what I was saying. And a demographic threat? There's a people that I'm threatened by the sheer nature of just who they are. If I refer to any group of people in the United States as a demographic threat, that would be just unabashedly racist. But somehow it's allowed when it comes to the state of Israel. And so the whole notion of an ethnic nation state, that we need to maintain a majority of people for the integrity of the state to be maintained, automatically makes people who are not Jewish a problem to be dealt with. And for me, the breaking point was at the end of 2008, early 2009 with Operation Cast Lead. And I finally said, I can't, this is not complicated anymore. This is actually very simple. It's not a situation of, well, there's enough blame to go around. This is a situation of one more powerful side oppressing the less powerful side because of who they are. And I can't apologize for that anymore. So I began to be more involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And I continue to work in my congregation, who were remarkable in their ability to countenance a rabbi who was saying such things. I was very, very, very careful to, when I went out and spoke about these things, to say that I was not speaking for my congregation and that these were my private views. The bottom line is, I was very deeply associated with the congregation. And for some members, to have a rabbi and be associated with a rabbi who was saying things that were so painful for them was very, very difficult. So I decided to resign, and it was very enormously painful and even traumatic. And I didn't really know what I would be doing, but I had no intention of creating a new congregation when I left. I think I had had my fill of congregations, really. I think I wanted to take a rest from doing congregational work because it's very taxing work. But what happened was I was trying to figure out where I fit now as a Jew, because for many, many years, for 25 years, I had been a professional Jew. suddenly, I was a civilian. You know, I think JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, was my political Jewish home, but I didn't really have a spiritual Jewish home. And I didn't have, there were no congregations where I felt comfortable. And there were certainly none of those congregations would be comfortable having me, since I was fairly notorious in the community at this point. So a group of us became the nucleus for what ended up becoming Tzedek Chicago. And it happened quite unexpectedly. In fact, one day, two of the members of this informal chavura, this formal group that we created, just came to me and said, you know, we should start a congregation and we think you should be the rabbi. That was more or less what they said, you know, that you've been our rabbi for so many of us for so long anyways, and that's how we see you. And we think it would be important to have a congregation where people like us could feel comfortable. And people like us meant many things, but one important thing that it meant was that we didn't place Israel and support for Israel at the center of our Jewish identity. So we decided to create what became Tzedek Chicago, and we started by creating core values that everything we did in our congregation would ultimately be rooted in. And we made a point of saying that we affirm a Judaism beyond nationalism, and that we're not Zionism. We don't celebrate the fusing of Judaism and Jewish political nation statism. And we felt very strongly that that was something we named, because frankly, every other liberal Jewish congregation in the country is Zionist by default. And they don't have to say anything about that because it's assumed. We felt it was very important because we sensed there were growing numbers of Jews like us out there. So that's when we started. We started in the early summer of 2015, and we've been going ever since.
And so on I got a practical level. I don't know if it's week to week or day to day or month to month. What does sort of a Tzedek Chicago calendar look like? What do you guys do on a regular basis in terms of living up to the mission, to the description that you just described at your founding? What does it look like to be part of Tzedek Chicago and build something Jewish and new together?
On the surface, we look like most congregations. If you took a glancing look at Tzedek Chicago, we get together for Shabbat and holidays. We have family programs for families with young children. We have educational programs for adults. At this point, we're meeting more or less once a week. The first Friday night of every month is a Shabbat evening service. The second Saturday of every month is a Shabbat morning Torah study. And then we add the holidays and other kinds of events. We have an informal relationship with lots of community groups in Chicago in terms of the social justice work that we do. The Chicago chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace being a very prominent one. But if you take a deeper look, I think we're really exploring what it means to create a congregation that espouses these values, and how can we express these values within a congregational context. So in our religious services, what does it mean to have a congregation that's focused on justice and has a universal as opposed to particularist point of view. And we're not praying for justice all Yisrael. We're looking for justice as Jews for all people. You know, rather than just tweaking little words here and there, what does that mean in terms of our liturgy? What does that mean in terms of our text studies and our we're starting to think about what does that mean in terms of the education of children as they get older? In terms of our diasporic approach, we're really trying to educate ourselves and raise awareness about Jews throughout history, throughout the Jewish diaspora, and not simply in our immediate Western Ashkenazic context. And inviting folks to our congregation that can raise our consciousness and awareness about what diasporic Judaism could look like in the 21st century.
When you talk about sort of Zionism, I'm interested in sort of your reflecting on what we've been learning about and thinking about in this series, which really started with some discussion from a couple of historians about Zionism before the State of Israel was created. You know, that there were other understandings of Zionism in which, yes, there would be something going on in the land of Israel. Maybe it would be a state, maybe it wouldn't be a state. But the function of Zionism was a sort of renewal for the Jewish people in a bigger way, and that something going on in the land of Israel would be an important part of that. And I guess my question is, as you reflect on this now, do you kind of think that Zionism was problematic from the beginning, that it took a particular course that ultimately led to a place that you kind of can't get it out of anymore? I mean, what I guess I'm saying, like, why do you take the approach that says, you know, the problem is Zionism as opposed to, you know, the problem is the current Israeli government or whatever, and we need to fight to have change, but that ultimately, if we could fix Israel, fix Zionism, that would be something good for the Jewish people, or do you not think that it would be?
It's very true that prior to the establishment of the State of Israel, there were many forms of Zionisms, and Zionism emerged in Eastern and Western Europe in a very unique Jewish modern historical moment. And there was a time in which it was a very rich debate about what this Jewish renewal might look like. And right, Ahad Ha'am was talking about cultural Zionism that wasn't necessarily predicated on Jewish sovereignty, but rather Jewish renewal through reviving culture in the land. And there was Herzl and political Zionism, there's Jabotinsky and revisionist Zionism, and there were religious Zionists, there were labor Zionists. It was and then there were binational Zionists. I mean, Judah Magnus and Hannah Arendt and Gershom Scholem and Martin Buber, they would all be considered anti-Zionists today. They were proposing a binational state that was shared equally between Arabs and Jews, that was not exclusively a Jewish sovereign state. Once the State of Israel was created, the only form of Zionism that really made a difference in the lives of real people who were living Jewish and non-Jewish was political Zionism. And yes, Jewish culture has been reborn, but it's been reborn on the backs of another people. And this was something that people like Magnus and Arendt were warning, even before the State of Israel was created, long before the State of Israel was created, that the political Jewish nation would come at the expense, as Hannah Arendt put it, at the expense of a homeland. So, you know, when people say, well, there are many different forms of Zionism, that may be true historically and that may be true intellectually, but in terms of reality, in terms of real facts on the ground, the only Zionism that really matters in the lives of people anymore is the State of Israel, the Zionism that is embodied by the State of Israel. So I think in many ways, it's a bit of a dodge to say, well, there are many ways to be Zionist. I think that's maybe intellectually true, but in terms of what's really going on in the world, the only Zionism anymore that really has impact in the world is the kind of Zionism that is embodied by the state that's been created in that land.
So I have a question that relates to all of what we're talking about with Zionism, but I think also brings up a different set of issues about how we construct institutions when we try to change Jewish life from within existing structures and when we start up new institutions. And so I guess I'm reflecting on so many conversations I've had with people over the years. And often what people say to me is, well, if you don't like what our institution does, just leave and start up some other one. And it's not that in a direct sense that's what went down here, but indirectly what has happened is you and a growing community have set up an alternative for what it means to be Jewish in Chicago, say. And I think many around the country and to some extent the world look at what you're doing as perhaps a model of the kind of thing that could happen elsewhere. I'm curious if you were somebody out there listening who feels marginalized or at the very least not at the center of their existing Jewish institutions, would you push people to sort of look for change within synagogue structures that they're a part of, look for change within other kinds of Jewish institutional structures? Would you push people to start up new institutions in the image of Tzedek Chicago or at least similar to it? Or would you push for some sort of combination? How do you look at those kinds of questions?
I would push for all of the above. Change is essential, and I think there's room for every approach. Sometimes I put it, there's need for the inside game and there's a need for the outside game. And I played the inside game for a long time, and it was, as I said before, enormously difficult, but it was also quite amazing. I mean, we were able to have congregational conversations and that included a wide tent that I think was quite unprecedented in many ways. The one thing, though, that I think about is and I have many rabbi friends who I admire greatly, who are doing the inside game, who are trying to widen the tent to include the voices of non-Zionists and anti-Zionists. And I'll tell you, it's really hard. I don't think you could name one congregation in the country that unabashedly says on their website or in their brochures that we're an open and inclusive. All liberal congregations like to say they're inclusive. We love that word. Of course, no congregation is inclusive. And when it comes to Zionism, that is definitely the case. There isn't one congregation in the country that will unabashedly say we're a wide tent for Zionists and non-Zionists and anti-Zionists. There are some who are really doing amazing work at pushing that envelope, but there's a reason why that kind of inclusivity doesn't exist. And I think it's at the heart, I would say it's a moral issue. If you are someone for whom Israel is a very central and sacred and important part of your Jewish identity, and on the other end of the spectrum, you're someone for whom you believe your religion has been used to perpetrate a political system that privileges Jews over non-Jews, it's very difficult for those two people to coexist under the same tent. Very, very difficult. And if you have a rabbi who is on one or the other side, and I can attest to this personally, it's very, very difficult for you to feel safe, I think, with a rabbi who's trying maybe the best they can to create that white tent, but when they're outside that tent talking in the community, they're speaking their conscience in one direction or another. So I say there's that the inside game is important, but I also say that it's really hard. For me, I'm 55 years old, and I'm thinking more consciously about how I want to spend my time professionally before I retire, if I ever retire. And I think for me, the work I'm doing now in creating alternative congregation and alternative approaches is where I want to be and where I need to be.
I wanted to sort of follow up on this line and on this question because, you know, I think a lot about the trends in a lot of congregations that even if they don't do it very well, they're often trying to say, oh, you don't believe in God? Well, have your secular Torah study here in our building. You know, please have it here, right? We're not necessarily going to change the service, but we want to open ourselves up to all sorts of Jewish expression and, you know, do that with real sincerity, with real goodwill. And that's not happening with Zionism. And I guess the question is why, you know, if you could reflect on why, because it sort of seems that, it even goes beyond not inviting those. It's about the sort of boundary policing of saying, not only are we not inviting folks who don't agree with us on this point to still nevertheless participate in our building or do their thing in our building. And in fact, we are uninviting them. You know, we really don't want them here. And I guess I'm just trying to understand the anomalous nature of that move in a world in which Jewish organizations are otherwise desperately trying to appeal to every Jew they possibly can. And this podcast is really about the fact that a lot of them are doing so pretty badly, you know, and are just sort of falling over themselves and not doing a good job, but at least they want to, you know. And I don't think there are a lot of folks running synagogues that listen to this podcast and say, you know, I wouldn't want to serve those Jews who feel like they're not being served, except for this one issue. And I guess I'd just really love to hear your reflections, having sort of been on both ends of it, to sort of understand why is Israel different from every other element of being Jewish, especially in the realm of liberal Jewish synagogues?
I think Israel has become the, you know, the ikar, the sacred central principle of Jewish life in our day. You know, there's a Hebrew Talmudic expression, kofer ba'ikar, someone who breaks with the central principle, and that's meant to, it's basically a euphemism for an apostate, a Jewish apostate who breaks the, if you pardon the language of Christian hegemony, who breaks the cardinal rule or the commits the cardinal sin. And, you know, I think for centuries of Jewish life, that was, you know, denying the existence of a God of history or a just God or the coming of the Messiah. I mean, there are certain tenets of traditional Jewish life that were considered really central to what it meant to be a Jew. And I think after the Holocaust and the creation of the State of Israel, Israel became the ikar. You could eat pork on Yom Kippur and you would find a place in a congregation. You know, no one would toss you out of the community. But if you stood up and said, I'm not a Zionist, or I'm against the idea of a Jewish state, that safely puts you outside the boundary of the Jewish community. And I think it has to do, it's an enormously powerful draw, I think, for Jews post-Holocaust, that this enormously traumatic communal experience that we're still feeling the remnants of even today, followed by this seemingly miraculous establishment of a Jewish state. It was the historical playing out of the most mythic of paradigms of, you know, death and rebirth. And, you know, I think it has to do with fears that are left over from the Holocaust. It has to do with survival issues, which Jews perennially have. I mean, there's all kinds of political and psychological and even spiritual reasons as to why we've given Israel this sacred status. But, you know, if you really think about it in terms of the narrative that has played out, in some ways it feels like, well, of course this is what happened. How could it not have happened? You know, in the myth of Zionism, this was a land without a people for a people without a land. In the real world, there were people on that land. And these warnings were sounded by Zionists, some Zionists like Ahad Ha'am and others, even before the establishment of the State of Israel. If we go ahead with these political designs, there's going to be tragedy. We're waking up from that blissful dream to see that it's not all that we hoped it would. It's the dream, you know, Hatikva, which is the national anthem of Israel, may be one thing, but the reality is another. I can't justify living according to that dream anymore, not as long as it's a nightmare for another people.
Okay, so I have a clarifying question I want to ask about the terminology of non-Zionist. And I also have a hypothetical scenario I want to throw out there and see what your thoughts are. So first, I'm thinking about the framing of a non-Zionist synagogue or a non-Zionist Jewish institution. And I think it could be heard and interpreted in two different ways. So a synagogue that is many things devoted to issues of social justice, etc., Zionism is not one of those things. That's sort of one way of reading non-Zionist. It's an institution that is not Zionist and does other stuff. The other read is that non-Zionism is in and of itself a value, and we are a synagogue that stands for the value of non-Zionism and the goals of universalism that you've talked about beautifully. And I think that one could I get the sense that you're sort of towing a line that's really tough, but I admire your towing of it, which is being about Israel, but in a very different way, in a way that challenges the assumptions of the rest of, or at least many other institutions of Jewish life. And also being about a set of things that aren't Israel. And the hypothetical situation I'd come up with is, like, let's say we have a Sunday school curriculum for a year that has 10 lessons about Israel. And there's a few different ways that one could try to make that better in the future. Let's say we have a typical curriculum designed to make people love Israel. One way to try and do it better is to change the content of those lessons so that you hear about Palestinians and you hear about the occupation, you talk about the founding of Israel, you debunk some myths, and you talk about the narratives that are often unheard in the Jewish community. And that's one frame. The other would just be have fewer lessons about it. Have a couple, have two instead of 10, and create a Judaism that just doesn't have as much Israel in any direction, that is about the diaspora, or even the term diaspora implies like, oh, we're the things outside of Israel. It's about American Judaism or about Chicago Judaism or about whatever. And so I guess I'd love to hear from you sort of, how do you envision a future Judaism? Is it that we are relating to Israel and to Zionism and to Palestinians and to Palestine in drastically different ways, but at sort of the same level, like the same volume? Or is it that dynamics are such that the only way to improve the matter is that we need to sort of minimize the volume because it's hard to change the nature of that volume?
Wow, that's a really great question. So a few things just to start. I will confess I'm not crazy about the term non-Zionist. I feel like we only use it because we have to, because Zionism is the default value in the Jewish community. We need to explicitly state that we don't toe that line. But I'm not crazy about defining yourself in opposition to something else. So in terms of how we stress things, there's a few answers to that. One is that we value the liberatory thread in Jewish tradition, that we believe the most sacred aspect of Jewish tradition is the imperative to free the oppressed and to stand with the oppressed and to call out the oppressor. Because of that, we stand with Palestinians, because we believe that Palestinians are being oppressed, and that it's this political system that has been set up, that's embodied by the state of Israel, that's oppressing them. I would say, you know, that when we're talking about how to educate, whether it's children or adults, that it be balanced. When we're talking about Jewish life, we're talking about Jewish life throughout the diaspora. It doesn't mean we ignore issue, but I think we reset that balance to some extent. But I also think that when we're talking with young kids, I don't think it's necessary to teach kids about nation statism and nationalism. You know, if I learned that my kids were learning all kinds of patriotic crap about the United States, you know, when they were young, I would probably react viscerally to that too. I think as we get older, we can struggle with the politics of nationalism, and in a way that has more depth to it. As they get older, to encourage children to or young adults to wrestle with this reality and to understand it in a deeper way, but not create curricula that are, as you put it, tailored to create a love or connection to the state of Israel. And if you talk to principals of Jewish religious schools, I would say the majority of them would tell you that an important goal in their school is to create connection with the state of Israel. There's many other things in terms of the values that we hold dear that we should be instilling in our children. So I wouldn't ignore it. I would try to reset the balance. But, you know, the final thing I'll say, I guess, about this is that whether we like it or not, Israel is at the center of Jewish life, and it can't be completely ignored. We just need to think very consciously about how we present it so that it reflects the values that we want to express to the members of our community, whether they're children or adults.
I want to pick up on something that you said when you were talking about educating about Israel and it just being hard to do that, even if you were inclined to do it. And I think that one of the reasons is, you know, it's very hard to build, I think, a love for a place that you haven't been, or that even that you have been once or twice. And the reality is that for most American Jews, that's what they're going to do. They're going to go once or twice. But it puts me in the mind of the fact that American Jews also more or less go once or twice to synagogue every year. And, you know, one of the challenges of synagogue education in general is, you know, how and why are we orienting our education towards something that these folks are not actually going to do very often? But that doesn't mean that they're not going to do Judaism very often. They do other things. And, you know, it feels like the synagogue is built on the basic business model of a gym, which sort of depends on the fact that the folks are willing to pay the fee. They don't want the gym to do something different from what it already does, but they may not participate at all, but they're still happy to pay the fee for whatever reason. That was the old model of a synagogue. And it sort of seems like, at least in my estimation of what's going on in the synagogue world, that the problem is that the folks who are willing to pay the fee but never attend have sort of fallen away or are falling away. And so the new model of a synagogue feels to me like it has to be a synagogue that really serves most of its members, that most of its members are actually getting real and continuing value out of their membership. And that means it's going to have to be very different, whether that means that it's going to be much more narrowly tailored to a particular kind of person, because only those kind of people are going to come again and again. You won't have to create a big tent because, you know, you don't need the big tent in order to survive. You can survive with a smaller, more focused tent, or some other way that the synagogue model is going to have to change. And I guess I'm wondering whether in building Tzedek Chicago, whether that was your intent or not, you're discovering things that have significance beyond Israel in terms of perhaps the future of synagogues or other types of institutions in American Jewish life.
I agree with everything you just said. And why I was so hesitant to create a new congregation was precisely for the reasons you said. I've felt for a long time that congregational Judaism is a sinking ship, and we're sort of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, as they say. And, you know, I was joking about liberal synagogues being inclusive. And I like to say, we're not inclusive. We are very exclusive. These are our values. And if you share and dig our values, join us. But if you don't, that's fine. There are plenty of places you can go. And, you know, I think it's meaningful for people to belong and support those values and that kind of a community, whether or not they physically show up or not. And we have members, we have dues paying members, or even people who are, you know, get our weekly emails or on our Facebook group from all over the world. So one of the things I've come to realize is that we need to get away from, you know, fee for service mentality. We need to build values based communities that stand for something other than just being warm and inclusive and informal and friendly and, you know, all the adjectives that liberal synagogues use to define themselves. But really, when it comes down to it, you don't really know what it is from a values point of view that they stand for, other than all the wonderful stuff that we all take for granted. I think that's key to the new congregations, that people feel like they're part of something that really makes it stands for something in the world. So I as you can hear, I'm very cynical. I'm cynical about congregational Judaism, and I don't know all the answers. I often say that we're making this up as we go along. You know, in my former congregations, usually what guided the decisions we made had to do with fiscal reality. It had to do with how are we going to get more dues paying members. It's going to be how are we going to make our mortgage. And ultimately, when it came right down to it, those were the guiding principles behind, because most synagogues are nonprofit organizations. And for us, I feel, and it sounds a little Pollyannish, but, you know, as long as we keep our values in front of us, I think we're going to be all right. And that's, you know, what that looks like is still sort of unfolding.
What's something you've experienced at Tzedek Chicago with your congregation, with folks that are inspired by the values that you do cherish and espouse? What sort of a snapshot into the most magnificent moment of Tzedek Chicago? Maybe there is something here that could yield a brighter Jewish future, whether that's just in the diaspora or whether that's really all around the Jewish world.
Our very first High Holidays, you know, we had over 200 people. You know, we started at the beginning of the summer, so the High Holidays came at the end of the summer. And I put together a liturgy, High Holiday liturgy, as best I could. And we had a lay cantor, but it was not the most professional enterprise, you can imagine. But there was such an electricity in that room. the sense that people felt like there was a place where they could just be their whole selves, you know, and it almost, it mattered what we did in the service, but on a deeper level, it just mattered that we were together. And, you know, I think it's about people who, for whom the issue of Israel-Palestine has been a stigma or a very real blocking obstacle point that keeps them from fully being part of a Jewish community. And just to be able to be unabashedly themselves in a community, I can't tell you how many people told me just how moving that was to them.
So thank you so much for joining us for this episode. I have one last question / thought. We get notes from listeners about a variety of all sorts of questions and comments about our episodes. I've heard on a number of occasions from folks who themselves identify as something other than Zionist, that are really appreciative that we on our show are ready to have perspectives from people that are all over that map of Zionism and anti-Zionism and non-Zionism. And so I guess just what would you say to those folks out there who don't, who aren't in a place that has ascetic Chicago and are yearning for that energy that you described on High Holidays, of that feeling of being their full selves but aren't there yet? What would you say to those folks who don't feel that way and would love to sometime?
I would, you know, depending on where they are and what kind of a critical mass of other like-minded Jews there are around them, I would encourage them to think in terms of startup. But I'd also let them know that there are communities that are developing all over the country. And in fact, the first meeting of a network of these communities just occurred back in May. They're very different from one another. Some are congregations like us. There's a new congregation, Hinenu, in Baltimore by recently ordained Rabbi Ariana Katz. There are davening groups, there are chaburot, but all of them are articulating non-Zionist values, among others. So there's something going on. And what I would tell the hypothetical person is that it is growing. And there are ways that you can plug into these communities, even if you're not geographically next to one. You know, I've heard from these people from all over the world. From the UK, and, you know, saying, I wish we had something like this where we are. And it's hard to hear that, but it's also, it gives me hope that I know the need is out there. And if there's enough people who are able to connect with one another to fulfill that need, I think we'll be able to see the growth of something very special.
Well, thank you so much, Brant Rosa, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you both. And I want to say, finally, one of the things that gives me hope is that, you know, you invited someone like me to be on your show. it says a great deal about your own vision and your own courage that you're widening the tent the way you are. So, of course, I appreciate a venue to, you know, where I can talk about things that are important to me, but I really appreciate that you're offering this kind of venue to the Jewish world. I think it's really important.
Well, thank you. I mean, it means a lot to hear that from you. And also just, I want to say we're trying to fill gaps. We're trying to look out at the Jewish landscape and see what's missing and whose voices are being sidelined and whose voices are being centralized. And we're trying to be a venue where the folks whose voices aren't heard so much in some circles can be. So that's what we're hoping to do with this episode and with so many of our other episodes. So thanks again to Brant Rosen for joining us. And we're going to close out this episode, as we always do, by encouraging all of you out there listening to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to Twitter at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we'd like to make is that you can always support us with a financial donation, either on a monthly recurring basis or just a one-time gift, and you can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.